On our show coming up today, we have two by Jeffrey Sachs. The first one was recorded on the 12th of March of 2026, and it's titled Something Just Snapped in This War. And the second one was recorded the following day, the 13th of March, and it is titled U.S. and Israel Underestimated Iran. And that was published through a program called The Heat on YouTube. So here is Professor Jeffrey Sachs.
It is, in my view, not shocking that we see these wars of choice. They've been true all through my career. The brazenness of this is something different, as you note. There's not even an attempt at an excuse. There's not even an attempt at any kind of process. The American people are completely against this. Why is this? Two reasons. One, we have slid into imperial behavior over decades, and so all of the real institutions of control were long ago pushed aside. But second is the particular personality of Donald Trump, a dark triad personality of megalomania, malignant narcissism, and psychopathy. This is something different. You should not have a person like this as president. This is especially of such a powerful country. This is extremely dangerous. So we have this mix, but the underlying reasons is the erosion of the most basic constitutional checks. After all, I have to point out from a juridical point of view, the UN Charter is not only something that the US subscribes to, it is the law of the land. It is a treaty duly ratified by the United States Senate in July 1945, which under our Constitution makes it the law of the land. But we hear little of the Constitution. The Supreme Court, thank God, rallied a few weeks ago and said Trump can't set the whole trade regime. That's unconstitutional. That was a glimmer of light. But when it comes to foreign policy, sadly, those same nine justices would like, I don't want to put words in their mouth, God forbid, but would likely side with the imperial presidency. Why does Europe have not a word about this? Well, this is what we've been asking for years. How did Europe become a complete vassal of the United States, which it is? It is a little hard to understand. Partly it's the selection of the leaders, which have to go through the US approval mill, or they get pushed aside easily. Partly it is simple mechanics. If you have US military bases on your soil, you are an occupied country, whether you like it or not. You have the CIA there, you have subversion, you have US direct political interference. You are a semi-occupied country. But I have to just tell you how shocking it is to hear this. I was at the UN Security Council last week. I had been invited to testify about the war, and then the UK and the US blocked me from testifying. This is par for the course. That's the least of it. But as I listened, of all people, the Danish ambassador launched into a tirade against Iran on the day that the US and Israel attacked Iran. She couldn't mention that Iran had been bombed or that 150 schoolgirls had been murdered or that this was a violation of the UN Charter, an unprovoked attack by Israel and the United States. She didn't even mention that. She just went into a tirade against Iran. This is the one that someday will turn to the UN and say, how can you not help us with Greenland after the United States has invaded her country? I went up to her afterwards to have a word. I wanted to point out that this is not safe for Denmark. She looked up from her notes, looked at me, turned around, and walked away. I called after her, could I have a word with you? Walked away. And so this is the state of affairs in our world today. Europe is useless. We know it. We bemoan it every day. Useless. Not a voice of sanity, except for Pedro Sanchez. Let's champion him because he's been very brave. And President Connolly of Ireland, who knows about this. But for the rest of Europe, nothing right now on this point. And so the U.S. and Europe don't uphold the learnings of World War II or the law of the international community in the UN Charter. We've lost the reflexes for that. And sorry to ramble on, but in 2003, many European countries, and I remember walking across the green with Dominique de Villepin, who had just spoken at the UN Security Council, France objected to the U.S.-Iraq war. Wonderful. We don't hear a voice like that in a major European country now.
No, we don't. Let's talk about Iran, because my own clear sense is that there's been very little understanding of that country. There were a lot of assumptions that this war was going to end very quickly. There's been a universal belief among Western leaders that the government is not only unpopular, but illegitimate in some way, never exactly explained, that the course of the war has come as a terrible surprise, that nobody expected that it would have dragged on in the way that it has. And you are starting to see in the media, certainly here in Britain, what you might call the worm of doubt. People are asking, is this going to go on for a long time? Is this going to turn out well? What if it doesn't? What if we've underestimated Iran? What if we've underestimated the strength of its institutions and its armed forces and its level of economic and social cohesion? Well, if they have underestimated all of those things, that really does argue again about their planning, their quality of planning being completely wrong, because as you say, they've been thinking about doing this for years, for decades. They should have a very clear understanding of Iran, and it seems that they don't. I mean, is that also your perception? I mean, it's certainly mine, that they really don't understand Iran, perhaps because they've fallen in with these grotesque ideas of domination of the Middle East, domination of hegemony, domination of all sorts of things. And one of the things I've learned in my life is that people who lose touch with reality on one thing eventually lose touch with reality on everything. Is that what the problem is?
I have a general principle which I've tried to get instated for many, many years, which is that the United States should not be allowed to bomb any country unless more than half the U.S. population can name two cities in that country. This would end all American wars. Americans know nothing about Iran. And that includes our leadership. Of course, I'm being jocular. We should not be bombing other countries, period. But the ignorance is beyond imagining. Donald Trump, of course, knows zero about everything. Everything. The man is a complete, total ignoramus. And that is not my testimony. That is what I hear from leaders around the world that deal with him. He's simple-minded, and this is also extraordinarily concerning. No, they don't have a plan. They don't have a strategy. They are relying basically on an old CIA failed ploy which is get the U.S. into something and then escalate as needed. So that's not a military strategy. It could take us back again 64 years to another CIA concoction, which was the invasion of Cuba, the Bay of Pigs in April 1961. They had no plan, but Alan Dulles thought once we get people on the ground and if they get under attack, Kennedy will have to call in air cover and we will be in a full-fledged invasion of Cuba. Now the plan is we'll escalate as needed. That's why Trump talks about now openly, well, we're going to have to put soldiers in. We're going to have to put the boots on the ground, as it's called. I don't think this is going to happen, by the way, because the United States public is so much against this, at least 3-1 against it, and it's going to go to much longer, stronger opposition very, very soon as people see how completely reckless, violent, boneheaded all of this is. But the answer to the question is they do not have a plan. Netanyahu's plan is get the U.S. involved. Those who favor this have the plan that once we're involved, we'll just escalate as necessary. The whole thing is a complete concoction and debacle. And the best evidence of that is the market judgment, because that's a kind of summary of those who are whose money is directly at stake. Today, oil prices have soared well above $100 a barrel by some quotes that I saw just in the few minutes before we started, up to about $120 a barrel. Oil is on the route to doubling in price over this very early stretch from pre-war price until today. It's not quite there yet, but it's headed there. This is an economic calamity, but the point is that those who put their money down in bets and the market bet on energy is the cleanest and clearest of this bets is that we have a disaster unfolding.
Let's talk about that, because you're perhaps the best person to discuss this. $120 a barrel oil, we have already a very difficult economic situation in Europe altogether. In Germany, they've been talking about deindustrialization. In Britain, there's a strong sense of economic malaise. In every Western country, people's living standards are under very, very great stress. $120 a barrel oil. What is that going to do to the world economy now, especially if this shock continues very long? And did the people who made the proximate decisions to start this now, did they not realize that this might happen? I mean, it was so likely that it would happen. How could they miss it? But tell us, first of all, about what are the possible outcomes. And by the way, before you do, can I just point to people what a prescient economic commentator you are in some respects? I remember when Trump brought in the tariffs, you said that the tariffs would not reduce the American trade deficit. They didn't, just to say. So given that kind of exemplary track record, what are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, if I could just say on the tariffs very briefly, I said, A, they're illegal, brazenly illegal. B, they wouldn't reduce the trade deficit. Three, they wouldn't create manufacturing jobs, which on our February report are down 100,000 jobs from last year to this year. The whole thing is so incredibly imbecilic. Okay, I'll put that aside. Yeah. On this one, you know, this is weird, but my PhD dissertation 46 years ago was on oil shocks. It was doing the first modeling of the oil shocks of 1973-74 and 1979-80, I wrote the first book about the economics of worldwide stagflation, published in 1982. So I've been thinking about this for decades, actually. The fact of the matter is this is an extremely, extremely serious shock to the world economy. It is likely to be prolonged. Of course, we're in the very first days, so things can change. But it doesn't seem like the U.S. is backing down, and it does seem like the energy facilities of the Gulf region and Iran are being destroyed or heavily damaged. And one country after another is shutting in its production because you can't produce if you can't store or ship. And they can do neither right now. So we're seeing soaring oil prices. We're seeing another important indicator, the volatility of the stock market soar once again. That's called the VIX index. That is also a predictor of a serious economic crisis. So I believe we're entering into a worldwide economic crisis this year. When it happened in the 1970s, output relative to trend, in other words, taking into account that world output has an underlying upward trend, and then comparing where things were a year after the oil shock from where they were would have been expected to be, the downturns in both 73, 74, and 79, 80 were on the order of 4 or 5% of world output relative to trend. Very sizable shocks. A lot of economic pain, a lot of unemployment. I think we're heading for that right now. Of course, things can change. These are early days, but at least as of the past few days, those who really are watching in minute detail what's being blown up, what production is stopping, what the chances of the U.S. military opening the Strait of Hormuz and so forth, what they're telling us is this is a very, very serious economic crisis lying ahead. And I think that it comes in the context of a lot of weakness in the U.S. already. The jobs declined in February. They've basically been stagnant or in decline for several months. Europe is in persistent crisis in a very weak state across Europe. So I would expect that this would mean a downturn in both the United States and Europe this year. Trump being insane, actually. Oh, so oil prices will go up. So it's the price we have to bear. The voters will have a different idea very soon. This will be true across Europe. There is revulsion at the political class in Europe. There is revulsion of Trump. And we need to remember, these are the people we see strutting on the stage. They are not liked. They are not popular. They are not following public opinion whatsoever. And occasionally, rarely, but occasionally, the public gets a say in this, and the say is not going to be a happy one. Of course, all of this depends on U.S. ballots actually being counted in November, which is going to be another drama coming up.
Mm-hmm. We're just having an election, by the way, in Baden-Württemberg in Germany, and the early reports are that the CDU has lost ground significantly and might lose the state. So anyway, we'll see. Is there any way back? Is there any way out of this mess? I mean, I have to say that the idea of sending in the US Navy to provide escorts to tankers, mm-hmm.
Yes, it's a delusion on a delusion on a delusion. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, so that's not going to happen.
That's not going to happen. So, I mean, what can be done? Because the other great change in the world is that the United States does not have the overwhelming monopoly over power that it did, say, 30 years ago. There are other very, very big players now. There's China, where Donald Trump is supposed to go at the end of this month. There's Russia, of course. There's India, too. There's all sorts of countries. One gets the sense that none of them are happy. What might happen? Might we actually see an international movement to end this war outside the West? That would be something very new if it were to be effective.
Yes, there will be a world rising demand to end the war as the economic pain hits. And that economic pain is going to hit quite quickly in prices, of course, for petrol and diesel and in electricity costs and in other ways. So it won't take that long for the pain to be widely felt. This is one point. That will cause politicians to scramble. What do we do? How do we survive? What do we say to our publics? The way that this war ends, and the only way, in my view, that it ends, is that the United States and Israel stop their war of aggression, period. I don't think it's going to end at the negotiating table. I don't see what the negotiations would be about. I don't see there being a possibility of negotiating right now, but there is absolutely the possibility that Israel and the United States stop the attack. Of course, that is a loss of face. Who gives a, and I won't say it, but basically, who could care that Trump and Netanyahu lose face? Despicable people who went against the world good. Of course they should lose face. They're disgraceful. We need the fighting to stop. It could stop if there is a crescendo of voices for it to stop. That crescendo will not start in Europe because they don't even have a voice that they know how to utilize right now. But that even that will come later. The voices have to start with where you absolutely indicated, and that is with the BRICS countries. China and Russia, of course, are allies of Iran. They're supporting Iran. The idea that, oh, they're giving intelligence, are you kidding? Why not? This is also a U.S. war directed against Russia and China, have no doubt about it. This is world hegemony at stake. Of course, they are going to give material support, financial support, military support, probably not direct troops, but a lot of other kinds of support. Of course, that's going to happen. But diplomatically, what I find most interesting is India. India, to my mind, is actually the decisive factor in this right now. Sad to say, India plays two roles, one of them completely erroneous for India, and the other very important. The erroneous role is India thinking that it will replace China as America's supplier, and that it will reap benefits as together with the United States and Israel against, well, with the United States against China and Israel as a provider of military technology and intelligence technology. So India has sidled up to the United States despite all the abuses. And it hasn't really ended that. Modi was in Israel a few days ago. For God's sake, what the heck is that? And there's also, well, there's other considerations, but that's one side. The other side is India should remember that its colonization by the British Empire wasn't a great party. It was a disaster. And the same with the United States, to become a vassal of the United States, to play with the United States and the Quad, suffer a calamitous energy crisis because India is completely energy import dependent from the Middle East because of a U.S.-Israeli war of imperialism is not what India wants. So India has the presidency of the BRICS this year. If India, Russia, China, Brazil, South Africa, the African Union, Egypt, Ethiopia, all stand up and say, this is outrageous. And if Europe, God help us, would follow Pedro Sanchez and say, this is not good for us, actually, the fighting will stop. After that, I think the consequences will be extremely significant. Of course, the U.S. will have been exposed as exactly Kissinger's adage has it, to be a friend of the United States is fatal. This will be proved yet again. I don't think Israel can continue in this mad, violent way after this. It will have created a worldwide crisis, not just a regional crisis. I think Israel, if it continues in this way, should be expelled or suspended from the UN, as South Africa was. It is a violent, vicious state that either regains its senses or is going to lose its hold. So this is going to be another reckoning that will come. But I think the way this war will end is the world telling the United States and Israel, stop, it's over, you're wrecking the whole world.
And that was Professor Jeffrey Sachs, recorded on March 12th of 2026. Next, we have another lecture by the same Jeffrey Sachs, recorded the following day, the 13th of March. And it is titled, The U.S. and Israel Underestimated Iran. So here is Jeffrey Sachs again.
Jeffrey, we have just heard from the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Mojtaba Khamenei. His statement was the first since he was elected by the Assembly of Experts. It was read on Iranian television. He called for unity among Iranians, and he said the martyrs will be avenged. And he also called on all U.S. bases in the Persian Gulf to be closed immediately, or they will continue to be attacked. He said the Straits of Hormuz, that vital sea route, will remain closed. Seems like he's taking a very hard line, not in the mood for any kind of compromise or negotiation. Given that, where do you see this heading?
Well, what kind of negotiation? Iran tried to negotiate twice. Both times it was bombed by Israel and the United States. Iran is under a absolutely brutal attack. It's under carpet bombing. The U.S. and Israel are destroying infrastructure. They murdered this man's father and the leaders of the Iranian government. They are killing thousands of people. So exactly what is to be negotiated? This is a brutal war of aggression by Israel and the United States. And Iran is responding. And it's not surprising that they are responding. They're under threat of conquest, basically. That was what Trump said, that he would pick the new leader, that Israel and the United States would run Iran. Well, the Iranian people have a different view, clearly. They're showing up by the millions to say that they don't want to be run by the United States and Israel.
Right, and President Trump is also claiming that the United States has won this war. That's what he says. Yet we see the missile attacks continue by Iran, by Israel, by the United States. I mean, do you envision any scenario in which the United States can declare victory when we don't even know what its objective is?
Well, yes, I see a scenario where they can declare victory. Trump does so. He says things for the immediate moment or for show or because he believes them. We're never absolutely sure which it is. But is there a way to real victory by the United States? No, this is a disaster for the United States. It is a disaster for the whole world. The U.S. and Israel have thrown the entire world into turmoil, perhaps into World War III. This was a brazen, violent, ill-thought-out, I mean, to say the least, move by these two countries, and now we're all suffering the consequences of this.
You say we could be in World War III. There are already more than a dozen countries involved in this conflict, most of them in the Persian Gulf. Do you see it expand to other parts of the world as well?
Well, the United States is at war in many places. It is at war in the Western Hemisphere. It invaded Venezuela. It's talking openly about invading Cuba, which it's currently blockading. Trump just met with Latin American leaders and talked about other military operations in the Western Hemisphere. Trump has threatened to invade Greenland. The United States is still heavily engaged in a war with Russia in Ukraine. We have war spreading through the Middle East. Israel is invading more countries. We have the war of Pakistan and Afghanistan taking place. We don't know, but it could be that when we look back even in weeks or months, we say, yes, World War III has started. The United States is so reckless, so irresponsible, and led by such a delusional president right now that I'm sorry to say that anything is possible.
There are more than 1,500 Iranians who have been killed in this conflict so far, but we also facing another crisis, that is an energy crisis. The world is facing an energy crisis right now. Oil prices are spiking. Energy experts say the full impact of this is yet to come. And we've just heard from the International Energy Agency, which says that this is the worst energy supply disruption in history. How will this affect and impact the global economy?
The way it's going, this year will be an economic catastrophe if this continues, and it looks like it will continue. We know that there are massive disruptions of oil supply. That's the point that the International Energy Agency just made. We know that only selective tankers are passing through the Strait of Hormuz, those that Iran is allowing to pass through for China and reportedly for India. But we know that there is a dramatic decline in availability of both natural gas and oil. And history has shown, especially in the 1970s, when there were two such oil supply disruptions, that the consequences for the world economy are extremely severe, sharp, and relatively rapid in arriving. So I think we're in for a very, very significant global crisis brought to you by Israel and the United States.
One strategy the Iranians are using, and some call it an asymmetric strategy, is to hit U.S. Persian Gulf allies, many of which host United States bases, of course. Iran is hurting their economies by targeting their oil supplies and oil infrastructure. It's also targeting vital energy industries. What do you make of this strategy by Iran and its effectiveness?
Well, Iran has been hit repeatedly by the United States and Israel, actually for decades. We can go back to 1953 when the United States deposed a democratically elected prime minister and brought in a police state for several decades. We can go to the war that the United States supported against Iran by Iraq in the 1980s. We can go to a long list of assassinations by Mossad and the CIA in recent years. What Iran is saying is we are under attack. This is existential. And the countries in the Gulf by hosting the enemy of our country that is trying to destroy us, are part of this war against us. Now, Iran has said, and the new supreme leader has said, that this is not a war against the neighbors, it is a war against the United States, which is trying to destroy Iran. And just listen to any of the words of Trump or Netanyahu, it's not hidden. It's very, very brazen. Who will run Iran? Trump or the Iranians? This is what's at stake. So from the Iranian position, this is existential. If the world stood up and told Mr. Trump, go home, you're not going to pick the supreme leader, and said to Netanyahu, live within your borders, stop making so many wars in the region, it would help us to get past this very, very dire crisis.
To what extent did both the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as President Trump, underestimate the Iranian military, not just its battlefield effectiveness, but also the strategies that it is using? It is taking on two countries, both nuclear-armed countries, in this conflict, vastly superior military forces.
The United States, during my entire lifetime, which is getting on, has underestimated its adversaries. From Vietnam onward, the United States repeatedly has declared victory in days or weeks, only to find that the wars extended years or decades, with the United States crawling back home afterwards, having failed in all of its stated objectives and having squandered trillions of dollars and cost hundreds of thousands of lives. So this is very common. Yes, they completely misjudged Iran. Totally. They said so, that this would be one decapitation strike, that people would come out on the streets against the regime, Trump would pick the new leader. This is the fantasy world of American leaders, especially Trump, who has the most delusional perspective of all. But we've had many presidents that are quite delusional in this regard. They are so drunk with military power that they completely misjudge the rest of the world.
As I mentioned, more than 1,500 Iranians have been killed in the conflict so far. That also includes 168 school children who were killed in perhaps the most egregious of those attacks, when their school was attacked in the south of the country. Preliminary investigations indicate, show that the United States was responsible for killing those children. It was one of its missiles that landed on that school. We look at South Lebanon, where the Israelis have been bombing the Lebanese there. 200 children have been killed there. And I was wondering, to what extent or how great is the risk, the likelihood, that we could see Israel do to Tehran and Iran what it has done in Gaza?
Yes, Israel has committed a genocide in Gaza because its doctrine is kill its adversaries, kill them in mass numbers, kill the civilians, kill the women, kill the children. This is the Israeli doctrine of war. They don't discriminate between civilians and military targets. They leveled Gaza. They destroyed all its infrastructure. They destroyed all the schools, the clinics, the mosques, the hospitals, the housing, the water, the sanitation, and we don't know the full death toll, but it almost surely is in the hundreds of thousands if you take not only the bodies that have been collected, which come to around 80,000, and those under the rubble, but people who have died of exposure, of lack of safe water, of nutrition, lack of access to health care, and so forth. This is a brutal regime. I'm sorry to say it. It's terrible. It is a rogue, brutal regime. It's doing the same in Lebanon now, and it's doing the same with its carpet bombing of Tehran in Iran. And the world needs to stand up and stop accepting this as something even remotely normal or acceptable. Israel needs to go home and live within its own borders and get its head together again, because it's acting in a completely, completely insane way. It needs to stop this. This is mass murder with U.S. complicity. So this is something that absolutely needs to stop.
Jeffrey, you know, as you point out, the world needs to stand up and stop this. But when we look at the number of children, for instance, that have been killed, and the fact that it's not receiving wide attention in the media, I mean, is there also a danger that the killing, the murder of children in this way, mass murder, as you point out, is being normalized?
It has been normalized because, at least in my country, in the United States, and in much of Europe, and thanks to CGTN for telling the news as it really is, our so-called legacy media or mainstream media do not report the truth. And we are subject to so much propaganda all the time, so much normalization. It's beyond imagining for me. I attended a UN Security Council meeting a week ago, the day, more than a week ago, the day that the bombing started. And what did all the Western countries do? They attacked Iran for being bombed. You know, this is propaganda. This is so-called narrative control. So yes, mass murder has been normalized. You're told, oh, if you say that Israel committed a genocide, oh, that's anti-Semitic. It's not only not anti-Semitic, it has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. It is the grim reality that needs to be understood so that it doesn't continue to happen.
President Trump is not discounting the option of a land invasion. And of course, this recalls the Iraq invasion. But if we look at Iran, Iran is much bigger. It's a mountainous country. It will not be an easy country for anyone who invades on the ground. I mean, this could result in massive U.S. casualties, couldn't it?
I don't believe it. I think Trump is full of it in general. And I don't believe this can happen. You know, when the Iraq war happened, the American people were lied to relentlessly. We know it wasn't an error of judgment or doubt. It was direct lies, propaganda, that there were weapons of mass destruction that needed to be taken out. It was the excuse for war. At that time, the American people supported the war. Now, the American people are completely against what Donald Trump is doing. And that opposition will rise over time as their gas prices go up and as their incomes go down and as their jobs disappear and so on. So for Trump even to think about putting troops on the ground, the political explosion that would happen in the United States would be absolutely enormous. So he's just facing the fact that every miscalculation has come to pass because he's delusional, because he has no strategy, because the whole group of them has no strategy. But I do not believe that there will be boots on the ground because, as you say, it would be a disaster and it would start in the stark opposition of the American people.
When we look at the U.S. history of military assaults, invasions, assassinations, just in the past 25 years, it's left a trail of mass death and destruction. How would you describe the damage and destruction the U.S. has left in the wake of what's been referred to as the Americans' forever wars?
Well, 30 years ago, Benjamin Netanyahu, when he became prime minister of Israel, with his American advisors, launched a project called Clean Break. The idea of Clean Break, everyone should understand, is to prevent permanently a state of Palestine alongside a state of Israel. So it's based on a criminality because it is international law that there needs to be a state of Palestine alongside a state of Israel. But the purpose of Clean Break was to say any government in the Middle East or North Africa or the Horn of Africa that supports the Palestinian cause and supports resistance, we're going to overthrow. And that is why there are so many wars, because greater Israel delusion of Netanyahu and the American complicity has led to wars in Libya, Sudan, Somalia, Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and now Iran. That's part of the doctrine. And it's crazy. Instead of just having a Palestinian state alongside the state of Israel, according to international law, we have wars across the Middle East that have claimed hundreds of thousands, millions most likely, of lives, and have gone on for 30 years now.
Professor Jeffrey Sachs, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we've been listening to Professor Jeffrey Sachs.